KDLL Public Radio provides the news, interviews, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Do you value local, responsible reporting or diverse music brought to you by your friends and neighbors? How about in-depth shows that are unique to your community? Then please support KDLL. We can't continue to bring you the local programming you enjoy without your support. Please visit kdll.org and click the donate button today.
In the studio, we have Velma Biddick and Will Hightower. Hi, how are you folks?
Good.
Good afternoon, Terry.
Good afternoon. I really appreciate you folks coming in and talking about gardening and such. I guess my first question is, this time of year, I didn't think there was much to do, but I was told I was wrong, and that's how the show came about, was, you know, there's plenty of things for a gardener to take care of in the fall, and maybe we can start there. Did I stump you?
Yeah, everybody thinks that spring is the busiest season, and it's the time when you start everything, but fall is the time where you put everything down and you get ready for a long sleep. So all of the things that you didn't have time to do in early fall because you were harvesting come to a head at this time of year, and it's a scramble to get everything done that you want to get done before we end up with snow.
Will, anything to add to that?
Yeah, everything you didn't get done through the gardening season, you got to get it done now. Plus, the garden debris is a very important thing because you want to get it out of there. Bugs, fungi, winter over in it, and so you want to get your beds prepared for next year, and it's easier now because it isn't soggy and frozen.
Oh, yeah. You know, 2 minutes into the show, and I've already learned something. I thought you just left the plant leavings in your garden because the nutrients would recycle, but that's not recommended, I guess.
No, it's not, because we just, you know, we don't have the, especially in the high tunnels that Velma and I do, we just don't have the temperatures to kill a lot of that stuff off. So you want to get it out of there. If you can, you want to cultivate your soil, turn it over. It disrupts the, the beds of the baddies. And so now's the time to get that done.
Huh, I had no idea.
In Alaska, the ideal situation, and you might end up doing this one out of 4 years, is to get all of your fall tilling and bedding done because the soil is drier and it allows you to till in the insect population. It puts some plant matter in, and it also gets you ready for spring. In spring, our springs are pretty wet normally, and we all get in a hurry in the spring. Every one of us has worked our soil too early and ended up with soil compaction. But if you can get some of that done in the fall so that Mother Nature takes care of that, she freezes the insect larvae and eggs, you have your expansion and contraction from your freeze-thaw, and it makes your beds beautiful to work in the spring. But in a year like this, where the fall has been so gorgeous, and we've all put off harvesting our crops, just let it go one more day, watch the weather. Sometimes this weather situation is a curse. Years ago, when we didn't have these wonderful weather forecasts, we tended to do things a little earlier because we never knew when we were going to get termination dust. Now we can watch the weather and we know. So we pushed our harvest back as long as possible. I was picking broccoli side shoots 3 days ago.
Oh, wow.
And we don't harvest our potatoes, and that is wonderful for our crops, but it tends to make us behind in some of our fall work. So everybody has to find a medium area there where they say, okay, it's time to harvest and it's time to prepare.
Wow.
Just going along with that, I'm still picking tomatoes.
What?
Yep, oh. I still have tomatoes growing, and I haven't even adjusted the root crops other than the potatoes. I'm behind, and so I got to cut this off and get home.
Oh man, have you noticed? You mentioned the nice fall weather we have now, and you know how it's not freezing up as early. How big of a change have you noticed since you started gardening up here?
Oh, in Alaska, there's been a radical change. I came up in '82, and the microclimates have changed so much. Of course, that's worldwide. I'm not even going to get into the debate of why it's happening. But there are definitely warmer temperatures. We're able to grow things now that we didn't grow 10 years ago, and a lot of things that we can grow here that we couldn't grow 15 years ago. So there are changes coming. I think it's a little drier. That's odd to say when we're having a deluge right now. But there are crops that I'm growing now that require some irrigation that didn't require irrigation 25 years ago. Potatoes is a prime example.
Really?
Potatoes will grow without any irrigation, but your yield is almost doubled if you supply them with adequate moisture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's changed a little as far as conditions. We're drier.
Tell me about some of the crops that are growing now that you couldn't grow in the past.
Well, like I mentioned, tomatoes, I think everybody's growing tomatoes now. And part of it is with these high tunnels that I mentioned. We had a wonderful sweet corn crop this year. In fact, last Tuesday, we had a panel discussion at the Garden Club about growing sweet corn in Alaska. You didn't hear this when I came up in 75 and there mm-hmm. was no sweet corn.
Oh,
So the gardening techniques have evolved. The temperatures have changed. Microclimates is a big factor depending on just what side of the hill you're on. It's all factors.
Wow. Somebody told me, and maybe this is because you couldn't used to be able to grow things like corn, they need darkness, that they won't grow in the midnight sun. But apparently that's an old wives' tale.
I haven't found a problem with sunlight. It was a temperature issue. In fact, when I first started growing this stuff in the high tunnels, I would vent the high tunnels quite heavily to keep the temperature down. And now I've learned that you want to get that temperature up there because tomatoes won't set. Corn needs that. If you grew up in the Midwest with hot, humid nights, you could hear the corn growing. Well, I think if I went out to the high tunnel at night, I could hear the corn growing.
Wow. I had never heard that about corn. But I did get to drive through Iowa last year. And it was a lot of corn.
We have access to a whole different seed and plant set than we did 25, 30 years ago. There's been a lot of research done. There are a lot of plants that are day sensitive. Actually, day sensitive is a misnomer because it's night sensitive, really, that the plants respond to. Onions and squash, winter squash, really respond to day length. If you go to the box stores and you buy a packet of onion sets, and they are a short day variety, they will not bulb up here.
Oh.
If you grow the wrong species of winter squash, they will not set, because they won't set during long days. They need shorter days. So you grow the wrong variety, and your squash will set in September, and then you don't have any maturation time. So we our access to different plant varieties, varieties that are developed specifically in the Northeast, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, that have are cold and wet soils. Oregon, there's a lot of plant varieties and seed varieties that come out of Oregon that tolerate damp, cool soils. So part of the success of gardening is the fact that we can inform ourselves of the right varieties to plant. And then your success rate is much higher than if you just grab a seed and plant it. You need to have a little bit of information about what your plant is capable of doing.
Now, I want to ask you both about seeds and how the different varieties. But we do have a phone call, and hopefully they have stayed with us. Hi, you're on the air with Velma Biddick and Will Hightower.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so, just that last minute was well worth being put on hold. It's just like, whoa. Seeds is precisely why I'm calling. This, earlier this summer, I bought a baby Swiss chard plant, and I clipped leaves off of it the entire summer, but I wanted to propagate it, and then I discovered that it's Swiss chard is a biennial plant. So I was wondering if I clipped it down to its leaves and put it in a larger bucket and kept it in a garage, what my chances of success would be in maintaining it through next season. Then number two, if I ever were able to get it to the point where I can collect seeds, how exactly would I proceed?
Ah, Will?
Well, you have just hit the black hole of my knowledge.
Oh.
I know nothing about Swiss chard. I would suggest that we do have an agricultural extension office out on K Beach Road, and they have a lot of publications there, and the ladies, a couple of the ladies there are very knowledgeable, but Swiss chard, I'm not sure I could even identify it.
Oh, Velma?
Swiss chard is a member of the goosefoot family. It doesn't lend itself well to holding over in the wintertime. It isn't a woody plant. It seeds the second year, but it'll also seed the first year if it's under stress. The problem with seed that develops in a stress situation is that it will tend to bolt the next year and go to seed. So if you save seeds from plants that bolt the first year when they're a biennial, then you have selectively, genetically selected for a plant that will bolt when you plant it as a vegetable. So if you save seeds from a plant that bolts the first year, if it's a biennial, and you plant, then a huge percentage of those plants will bolt the first year, and then you don't have Swiss chard. I would recommend, and the same also goes for broccoli and cauliflower, but they don't have the bolting problem as bad as just a foliage plant. So I would recommend that you just buy the varietal seeds of whatever comes. It's just not cost or labor effective to try and save a seed off of a goosefoot. Another goosefoot, for example, is the New Zealand spinach. It seeds the first year instead of the second year, and it gives you a good foliage plant. We have a problem with goosefoot greens here. Spinach is one of them because they like to bolt because of long days.
You guys have thank you for those that answer. You've used a couple of words. I wanna clarify because I don't know them. What is it for one of these vegetables? I think you guys mentioned gourds to set. And what is bolting?
Okay, setting. You on a plant, you'll get a flower. Sometimes these are male, female flowers. Sometimes they're just male, female flowers. To set means they've been fertilized, and it starts developing a fruit.
Oh, okay.
Now, bolting, when you get a, if you, lettuce is a good example. Your young lettuce plants, you pick the leaves, or you pick the whole plant. But if you just pick the leaves, eventually this thing will grow a stalk. It'll get tall, and it'll get leaves at intervals, and that's called bolting. And they tend to, especially like in lettuce, they tend to get bitter.
Ah.
And so you have to do some extra processing to even get a lettuce salad.
Wow. That's very interesting about them bolting. So that's like what you're saying, Velma, they're feeling like this is it, and they need to reproduce as quickly as possible.
The first duty of a plant is to reproduce itself. And so the best way to keep that plant from doing that is to not stress him. Because if he isn't stressed, or she, they continue to grow. But if they are stressed by extra heat beyond their parameters or drought, then they go, ah, seed. So in the fall, if you want your tomatoes to mature early, or you want your squash to mature early, or you want your strawberries to ripen quickly, that last set that is big and green, but it's starting to get cold, you stress them. And that forces maturity. If you continue to irrigate and you continue to pamper and you continue to keep the temperature high, they'll continue and they won't mature. So some plants you need to stress a little to force maturity.
Wow. Interesting. That sounds like my nephew.
No, you're not stressing him. You're stressing yourself.
Boy, that's right. I've seen seeds and seed catalogs and things I've looked at that there are these growing zones, but then you also mentioned microclimates. Is it just ask the expert where the microclimate is for this zone, and you got something on this side of the hill like you mentioned, Will, and that side of the hill, and how are you? How do you deal with the zones and the microclimates?
Okay, the USDA has the United States mapped into zones. And we're, I believe, in a zone 4?
3 and 4, depending
three and four,
on...
Okay, that is, zone, whatever zone we're in goes from here to Homer, this type of deal. It covers a large, it's a macro designation.
Okay.
Now, Alaska, it depends on what side of the mountain you're on. We live out in Sterling. Sterling is known to freeze out early in gardens. Okay. Well, we live actually halfway between Soldotna and Sterling, and even without our high tunnels, we freeze out later than other places. We have a microclimate there. And the reason we freeze out later is we're up on a hill, cold flows downhill, and plus we sit right between three lakes. So we have water modifying. You have so much of this throughout Alaska because of our terrain. And so we have microclimates. I could probably some years grow palm trees where the guy half a mile down the road, he can't even grow a strawberry.
Huh. Wow. And is that just you learned these things by experience, not to plant your palm trees at your buddy's house?
Yeah. That is, you can get your general knowledge. But like Velma, she has been working at this for years and years, and she has learned what works for her in her location.
What part of town are you in, Velma?
I'm on Echo Lake.
Oh, okay.
And I'm on a south, east-facing slope. So I have terraces on my property. And on the lower terrace one year, we got a frost, which is very unusual, the 28th of August. And we had potatoes planted at the bottom. This was when we were doing the high tunnel program, and I was running some trials. So we planted potatoes at the bottom. My husband, we had extra potato seed left, and he insisted on planting them. And it was a wonderful deal because it turned into a very informative situation. We also had potatoes planted on the highest terrace because we had a frost the 28th of August that killed every potato vine on that bottom layer. We harvested potatoes on the top layer, top terrace, on the 6th of October, and they were still 100% green.
Wow.
Now, that's a difference in elevation. Cold moves downhill, and there was a prime example of the difference in the temperature gradient as we moved up the hill. If you take the south side of the house and you've got an L, it's as good as a greenhouse. All you have to do is have something that shields it at night from the night drop in temperatures, sheet of plastic, row cover, and you can grow things in that little protected L that you could grow in a greenhouse.
Wow.
Because it's protected from wind. There's a heat sink from your house and your foundation. And it's just a protected area. So you might have a three on most of your property. South side, protected L, you could get up to a five.
Wow. Wow. And a lot of sun bouncing off the building, too, I imagine, in that situation.
Yep.
You guys have mentioned high tunnels a couple of times. They just started. I moved from Kodiak a year ago, and they had just started. A few people had just started putting in high tunnels. They had the low tunnel ones. The borough assembly was worried people were going to crawl in and die, and snow was going to fall on them. I don't know why it took forever for gardeners to get high tunnels approved by the Kodiak Island Borough, but it seems like the ideal ideal mechanism for growing some of these things. I mean, are there things you couldn't grow if they weren't in a tunnel or a greenhouse? They're just big greenhouses.
They talk about the new high tunnel program, but all of the old timers know that for years, and Will has a definition for high tunnel. He says it's a greenhouse without heat. And that's exactly what it is. And for years, clear back into the 50s or 60s, as soon as somebody figured out how to make sheet plastic, the people up here that were interested in growing food had little high tunnels. They were little greenhouses without heat stuck in the woods where the sun hit them, and they've used those for years. In fact, close relative was a state trooper, and they used to spend a lot of time flying, looking at all of these little, because of the marijuana that was grown in part of them. But there was a huge number of them that were used to grow vegetables, tomatoes, cucumbers that couldn't be grown anywhere else. And believe me, they were successful, and they produced way before the government got involved with our high tunnels. Wow. They've been around here for years and years and years and years.
That's good.
Okay, the term high tunnel, like Velma says, we're resourceful up here, and we knew about this, but finally the government got into this, and they coined the word high tunnel, and it started as a season extender. And they started a pilot program in North Dakota for truck gardens, because apparently there's a bunch of truck gardens down there that supply Minneapolis, Chicago, all these. So they started promoting this to the farmers, and then they started subsidizing them and stuff. And it proved successful down there, and then they put it on a test program across the nation, and it took off, especially up here, because of our growing conditions. And the reason that it took off up here in the way you're seeing it is the government's funding part of it. So anybody that's wanting to put these things up and put up with the government for a couple of years, they can get some of their costs defrayed.
Wow, is that USDA?
Yes, it's USDA through the the NRCS, which has an office here and one in Homer. Now, this is a national program now, and so anywhere you have one of these NRCS offices, you can get information on this. A little fact, the office in Homer has more high tunnel contracts than any other office in the U.S.
Wow.
It has become a really big thing down around the Homer area. And if you get up in an airplane, you can see it.
I have a friend I used to work with her at the Clarion years ago, Carrie Restino. And she moved down there, and she I think it's called Hilltop Acres or something. But they're up on the bluff there, and she posts pictures all the time. You know, every spring they're putting up giant new hoop house, and they're clearing acreage and stuff. And I think besides vegetables, I think she's getting into that flower market you hear so much about. Are you guys into that?
No.
No?
Peonies.
Peonies.
And that's a specialized, high-skilled,
yeah.
Is volatile, it? Yeah.
Very intensive labor, and personally, I'm kind of lazy.
I'm surprised that this, you know, let's just go to the phone here. And somebody else can ask a pertinent question. Hello, you're on the air with Velma Bittick and
ADLL.
Yes, hello.
Gardening show. Hi. I tuned in late. Have you already talked about potato scabs?
No, I don't believe we have. Do you have good questions about potato scabs?
Well, this is the first year I got them, and they're in a section of the garden that I didn't lime. And even in the same plant, in the same bed, there was potatoes that didn't have them and some of them that had a ton of them. And so the whole area was treated the same. So is there any suggestions about how to treat that area so it doesn't have that virus, or I'm not sure what it is?
What does the panel say? Thanks for the question.
I'm going to let Velma start on this thing.
The prevailing folklore is that you have to have limed soil to grow potatoes. Up here, limed soil is good for potatoes because it keeps the acid level higher and it inhibits the bacterial and fungal growth where you get scab. Some of the finest potatoes in the world are grown in alkaline soils. Idaho is a prime example. So understand that you can lime your soils and you will still have scab if that biome is in your soil. So there are places on the peninsula that grow potatoes and they never have any trouble with scab because that particular bacteria is not in that soil. So if you're planting potatoes and you've saved seed potatoes that have got scab on them and you put them in a place in your garden that has not had that bacteria, you're going to have some of it the next year. We transfer that bacteria, but that bacteria grows better in sods, grasses. So if you've got a ground that was soddy, that had a lot of grass in it, your chances are higher percentage of having a scab infestation. It doesn't affect the quality of the potato. It might affect the keeping quality a little, because the nodules tend to use a little moisture that's in the potato. But liming is not the one answer for this. You have a bacteria in the soil that contributes to that. Liming will slow it down, but it won't eradicate it.
I was thinking, I had been told that we should not lime in the potato section.
Well, liming raises your pH, but pH is not a complete factor in potatoes. If you lime, it raises your pH. Keeping your pH low, I said that wrong at the beginning. Keeping your pH low is not a guarantee that you're going to be scab-free.
Mm-hmm.
It lessens it, but if you've got the scab bacteria in your soil, you're going to have scab. If you're growing potatoes in soil that does not have that bacteria, you won't have scab, even if your pH is high or low. It's just a matter of what's in the biome of your soil that is the determining factor. If you want to lessen your chance in soil that is contaminated with that bacteria, then you keep your soil acidic, but that's no guarantee that you will have scab-free potatoes.
So you can't treat it with anything else to get rid of the bacteria?
No, not really. Okay. You could, maybe. I don't know. I've never tried it up here. Okay. I just refuse to put anything on anything that I don't absolutely have to. I'll peel a scabby potato before I'll put any kind of a chemical or additive on it.
All right. Thanks for the question. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I've got a question in my head that's just running around here. I'm sorry.
Potatoes. I do raised beds, and I manufacture my soils. So I don't use sods and that type of stuff. And I have found, and again, it doesn't totally eliminate it, but I mix in some sawdust, which tends to keep the pH lower. And that is the best solution I've come up. Plus, I rotate my potato stalk, and I rotate the location of the potatoes. Crop rotation is a very important thing, even in the garden, because if you plant the same thing in the same spot, you're going to get soil deficiencies, you're going to get diseases that affect that kind of plant. One of the examples is my sweet corn. Corn is a heavy feeder. You need to move that corn crop around. So like the potato patch, move it around is a measure you can take.
You know, one of the questions that was emailed in was about rotating crops. Is there a strategy? I remember reading that, I don't know who it was, they had like four plots and they'd always leave one rotating around that's empty, lying fallow. Do you guys have a strategy for gardens and large gardens and hoop houses and high tunnels and such?
The strategy for rotation is, it's extremely complicated. There can be 10,000 variables with crop rotation. I always said that it was much easier to rotate if you were farming 1,000 acres and had four crops. It's a little more difficult when you're farming 5,000 square feet and you have 19 crops.
Oh, sure.
You just kind of have to sit down with what your particular menu of plants is and how much area you dedicate to that plant. Find out which ones need to be rotated the worst or the most or the best and figure it out. There's so many variables. The only steadfast rule is don't plant back in. Some plants you can tolerate for 2 years in one spot. Sometimes need a 3-year rotation. It's one of those things that, let's face it, you just sit down with a piece of paper, graph it out, and make the best choices you can with your particular. It's one of those story problems you hated in the fifth grade when you were doing math, but it just has to be done.
Okay, on crop rotation, like she says, there's so many variables, and they're plant families. Okay, potatoes and tomatoes are both nightshade plants. You don't want to plant tomatoes in the potato patch next year.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, online, and you can get a kind of a little program. And a couple of seed outfits have this thing. Anyway, you can download this program, and you can build your garden, your different plots, and you can put potatoes in this plot, and then they go into rotation next year. If you, in that spot that you had potatoes this year, and you want to put tomatoes in there, you'll get a flashing red sign on this program, that, and it says no, 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 no. And 2 years out, maybe you get a pale orange or something like that. So there are aids to this crop rotation, and I found it's a good thing to do.
Do I understand correctly that there are some crops that you could put in a field that actually contribute to the soil? Like beans? Did I hear that about beans?
Legumes?
Yeah.
Beans and peas affix nitrogen in the soil through nodules.
Oh, okay.
Root nodules.
Mm-hmm. And can we grow any of those around here, legumes? That's a peanut, right?
A peanut is a legume, so is a field pea or a garden pea.
Oh, okay.
Or green beans. The peas do better outside. Green beans, in most cases, have to have a little microclimate or be grown. There are a few growers that can grow them outside, depending on what their climate is. Mm-hmm. But generally, that's a crop that needs to be sheltered in some way.
Oh. You know, on online, you often see people posting things, you know, that they're interested in. People who are interested, and I don't know if they're real gardeners, but I've seen it a number of times, and it's a photo of three different plants. I think it was like corn or tomatoes and beans and, man, I want to say something else.
Squash. Three sisters. That's what Native Americans have grown for centuries together. They complement each other, and they supply what the other plants need.
Wow. That was exactly what I was going to ask. Farmers do that actively?
It's called companion planting.
Oh, okay. So it is still an established practice?
It works very well in some situations. It's a little more difficult up here. We discussed that at the garden club the other night about squash and corn and beans. Mm-hmm. And generally in high tunnels, you're very, very limited to space. We grow all of our winter squash vertically on trellises, strings, and in the ideal companion planting with the three sisters, you have a circle of corn about 4 foot wide, and then you have beans on the outside of that and a squash in the center, and then you don't have anything that grows for 6 or 8 feet because that corn and the squash and everything are pulling moisture in to a little crop circle.
Oh, right.
And that's how it works ideally. In a situation with a high tunnel, you're a little more limited as far as space, and so it can get a little touchy with squash vines and beans and air movement and mildew, and there's just all kinds of issues. So companion works well in some situations, but it's not an ideal situation if you're growing in a high tunnel.
Oh, okay. Will, you mentioned corn earlier. We got a question online here that they're not really having success with the corn in their greenhouse, and they're wondering what variety.
Okay. I have found just off the shelf in the big box stores. There's an early sun glow. And
Ed Hume has a line of seeds that is very well adapted to this area, and they're available locally.
Now, one of the things in the tunnel that maybe they're not doing is that corn is air pollinated. It's not insect pollinated. So when the pollen starts falling, you need to blow it around. And I use fans. There's several different techniques, but I blow my fans from one direction for a day and another direction the next day, and maybe the third day I just let it fall down. Anyway, you have to have air circulation.
Ah, good point. You mentioned earlier, Will, that you make your own soil. Sounds like you're a composter. You do composting?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, and that's something that's a kind of a problem up here, because composting takes a certain temperature, and it takes room to do composting. We just do not get the temperatures long enough to really compost up here. So it's kind of just a muddying down. I have two alpacas, so I get a lot of raw material. And what I do is I go out to Sterling, and there's a gentleman out there that sells a peat dirt mix. And I have found that the weed seeds in his product is very few. So it's pretty good that way. I buy that. I get my my semi-composted alpaca, and I get sand. And I mix them in about equal portions. And I got started in building soil and finding it's easier than doing the native stuff, which I live on a rock pile anyway. I find it's easier to just manufacture my own.
What about composting in the wintertime? Is that a problem? I mean, I know they're supposed to generate heat, but is there anything you can do during the winter, or do you just send your kitchen scraps into the garbage?
Well, kitchen scraps, I have a worm farm in my shop that's heated, and they're working all year long. In fact, they've been working for 20 plus years. And I get a certain amount of really good worm castings.
Wow. There.
Okay. As far as the alpaca and any leaves and that type of stuff that I put in my bins, which I have four foot by four foot bins that I rotate this stuff in, it just shuts down for the winter. It's just too much work to try and keep it going.
Ah.
When we started composting, we were building piles, and we were rotating, and we were moving, and we were shifting. And my husband and I are in our mid-70s, late 70s, so pitchfork was not our best friend. So we've gone to a passive composting system. We have plenty of room, so we have compost piles scattered, and they usually set for about 3 years. They might get turned three or four times, but they're huge piles. They'll get 6-7 foot tall and 8-10 foot wide, and they're added to all year long and turned, and then they're left alone, and we start another one every year. And so you kind of do without compost for a while, but once you get that going, then you've got a pretty available supply. Now, one of the things that I was told when I first moved up here, I talked to an old timer, and I was interested in putting a garden in. And I didn't know that much about Alaska. I grew up on a farm. And he said, "See that alder patch on your property?" He said, "That's where you want to put your garden. Alders fix nitrogen. They're one of the few plants in Alaska that fixes nitrogen."
Wow.
And if you go out and you dig under the alders, you'll find that there is a foot, 2 foot, 2.5 foot of beautiful soil, and composted material. It's not as high acid as the soil that's under the spruce trees, and it makes wonderful growing medium. In fact, my dad, the first year when he was out working in the garden, he had disappeared for a while, and we asked him when he came back where he was, and he said, I was out there hoeing that rug you call a garden plot. There was so much fibrous material in it that it was difficult to till. That changed in about 3 years, and it was beautiful soil. So if you've got an alder patch, go out and dig around and look and see what's actually underneath that alder patch. There is beautiful material there, and it's got a very rich biome, a lot of fungal and bacterial life in that.
And that's the sort of thing you're looking for in a soil?
Yeah.
Oh, did not know that. Somebody has a question here about growing tomatoes, and I have experience in this too. Actually, I should say I have no experience in successfully growing tomatoes. And the question is there an easy variety or an easy way for like a home gardener, maybe not somebody on the scale of having a hoop house or a high tunnel or anything, but can innocent bystanders grow tomatoes?
Well, we grow tomatoes. In fact, the wife's been canning them. She had so many, or had enough, let's put it that way. We haven't really come up with we've got a couple good candidates, but we haven't come up with a finalist yet.
For the Alaska tomato?
Yeah.
Ah.
I think in the last 15 years, I've grown about 200 varieties.
Oh, wow.
And I've got about 11 that are keepers. I mean, there's not a bad tomato. There's some that are just a whole lot better than others. I tell people if they can grow a child and get it graduated from high school, they can grow a tomato.
Well, we're doomed then.
If you got a pet, is he still alive? You can grow a tomato. That's all it takes is the right amount of food, water, and light. You can even grow a tomato in a south-facing window. Temperature is important for set, and you can't just look at a tomato plant. If you don't have insects to pollinate it, you got to go by it two or three times a day and just whack it. Just pretend like you're a bumblebee. Those are perfect flowers. They don't require cross-pollination. You can just vibrate them, and the easiest, most efficient way to do it is just to smack it. Just make it shake.
Uh-huh.
And then keep your temperatures moderate. They don't like below 55. They'll drop a set at below 55. And they don't like above 95. Otherwise, sometimes they're cat-faced and they're deformed. And so water, good balanced fertilizer, organic or commercial, whatever is your bag, and you can grow a tomato. Some people prune, some people don't. It's just, there's a dozen ways to do something right, and there's a dozen ways to do something wrong, and all I can say is just stay with it.
I was thinking earlier when you were talking about one of the other plants, that there has got to be a lot of trial and error, that lasts for years. Well, to become a good gardener.
Why do you think we get addicted?
It never stops. You learn something every day. There is just so much out there to know. But don't let that discourage you, because it's a learning curve, and you have to pick something and then stay with it long enough to make it work. I would recommend that you determine what kind of a tomato you want. There's a determinant, which is a little guy, and usually his tomatoes all ripen within a month. Then there's the indeterminate, and that's the long vine that goes all over the place. And that one makes tomatoes as it grows, so you've got a longer harvest period. So, like Will's wife, she's canning. She's probably got enough tomatoes that it really doesn't matter whether it's determinate or indeterminate. But if you want to can a dozen quarts or pints of tomatoes, then you probably want determinant varieties so that they all ripen within the same time period. Otherwise, you're going to have enough for tomato sandwiches, but you're not going to have enough to put in a jar because they ripen differently. Then you buy a plant or seeds that will ripen within a certain time period. Some of the old heirloom varieties take 110 days. The flavor is absolutely incredible. But unless you want to drag that plant into your living room and babysit it till Christmas, that's probably not a wise plant to grow. You want something that matures in 68 to 80 days. That's, you know, that's your mm-hmm. best bet.
Wow. That is good to know. I think I've identified a couple of my tomato growing problems there. We're almost out of time here. I do have... Oh, go ahead.
I'd like to... We got sidetracked because there's so many people that are interested in growing. And part of the program was to be on getting ready for fall.
Yes.
This has been a strange year because it's been so beautiful. Now we're going to have rain. So you're not going to get a lot of your fall prep done. You know, don't obsess about it. You're going to have a mold problem. You're going to have maybe a few insect problems. You're not going to get stuff tilled under. There's some things that are really important and some that aren't so important. Mainly get your water lines and everything that can freeze and be destroyed. Get your tools inside. I had a week ago, I had garden tools hanging from all my trellises and stuff. Get them gathered in. The extension office has got an Alaska fall checklist and a winter checklist. Go down and get a copy of it. It's wonderful. An example of one of the things that they tell you to do is to get all your raspberry canes and everything cut. And I used to do that, but I found out that the wind and the snow destroyed my plants. So now I leave all my old canes in. I tie them with a soft cloth in bunches, and they help hold up the new canes so that I'm not dealing with canes that are 2 foot tall because they've been broken off by wind and snow. So there's nothing that's set in cement. Stay loose.
I think that requires the addiction that you're talking about there, Will, being able to keep all of this in mind, but also knowing what to stress about and what not to stress about. Yeah. I have one more question for you guys, and I understand if you wouldn't want to answer it. But marijuana is legal in Alaska now, and people have been growing it in Alaska for probably 60 years. Do young folks or growers come to you guys and say, hey, I could use some tips in growing my ganja? Have you guys gotten any questions like that since marijuana?
The problem there is young gardeners.
Oh.
I don't know that there is such a thing. They're out there doing their thing, but I haven't had anyone come. Oh, by the way, I have tried hops. It grows great in the greenhouse. I've had it for 2 years. I'm done with it. If somebody wants to adopt a hops plant, look me up.
Wow. Like hops for beer?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Man, I like that. Well, thank you both very much. I really appreciate your time. This has been very educational. And like I told all of my guests this morning, we should schedule like several hours to talk about this.
Hey, maybe you got a regular show.
You know, that would be nice. We had, when I was in Kodiak, there was somebody who did a gardening show for several years, once a week. Yeah, it was terrific. More phone calls than the news talk shows. People love gardening. Yeah.
And it's getting to be a really, really popular thing. People are interested in good food. And a lot of these young mothers, they want what's good for their children. Mm-hmm. They're really interested in buying food that doesn't come in a box.
I think we're off the air.
No, I'm just playing a little music here in the background. My guests have been Velma Biddick and Will Hightower. We've been talking about gardening and taking some phone calls. We appreciate all the phone calls. It is just about 1 o'clock, and I am going to make way for Jenny Nyman music. I think we got music coming up, local music for the next couple hours. Thank you again.
You're welcome. Our pleasure.
This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.